Well, joining us now to talk about all the week's news are two colleagues from the Boston Globe, Renee Loth. She's columnist and former editorial page editor. Welcome to Radio Boston, Renee.
Nice for being here. Thank you.
And the Globe's current editorial page editor, Peter Kanellos. Welcome to Radio Boston, Peter.
Thank you.
You can also join us with your take on the week's news. What was your favorite story, or maybe even your least favorite story that happened here in Massachusetts? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. Renee and Peter, let's start with those job numbers. I mean, it's great. 19,000 plus jobs, great news for Massachusetts, but Renee, probably great news for Governor Patrick as well in this election season we're in?
Yeah, you know, I went to a speech of the governor's before the Massachusetts Taxpayers Foundation on Wednesday, before these numbers were even announced, and he had a pretty good story to tell, quite apart from even this 19,000 figure. The Philadelphia Fed said that Massachusetts is outperforming 48 other states in the economy. The Moody's, we mentioned Moody's a minute ago, had declared the recession over in Massachusetts in March. So, you know, the economy is clearly on the move. And, you know, not surprisingly, Governor Patrick's, not unlike Governor Patrick's own campaign, is on the comeback trail. I do agree that there are you know, many people still hurting. The governor needs to, you know, walk that line between, you know, touting the recovery in the economy while still feeling the pain of those who are hurting.
Mm-hmm. And, Peter, yet we still have many months to go before November.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, Charlie Baker is kind of at a down moment right now. I think that there is the perception that that Patrick is kind of on the upswing. But because of the presence of Tim Cahill as a third-party candidate in the race, who's getting a lot of attention right now, we haven't really seen the contrast in visions between Charlie Baker and Deval Patrick that we might start seeing, you know, as we head towards the fall. And so I'm not making any predictions on where this governor's race is going right now, except to agree with Renee that Patrick seems to be, you know, on the upswing compared to where he was 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm. You know, Renee mentioned that there is some evidence that Massachusetts is outperforming just about every other state in terms of recovery out of this recession. Do you get the sense that, you know, we hear about those 19,000 jobs, but that the electorate is feeling overall that same sort of perhaps increasing optimism as well?
Well, I would say I don't think the electorate is feeling that sense of optimism right now. I think that, you know, politically, Charlie Baker is putting out the idea that Massachusetts is an absolute basket case, that Beacon Hill is in disarray, that, you know, people should be angry and grabbing their pitchforks and heading into the center of town. And, you know, I think that there's a substantial argument that's not the case, that Massachusetts, in fact, has a plan and has not fallen apart and is not doing poorly compared to other states. And that's sort of Patrick's retort. But whether that's enough to actually get people excited about the status quo, I don't know.
Renee, your thoughts about how people are feeling right now?
Well, you know, Massachusetts is part of the national scene. It's hard to separate us out, even though we like to think that we're, you know, one of a kind. So I do think that the national mood, which is quite angry, we saw a lot of incumbents turned out with pitchforks this week. I think that that mood has infected Massachusetts as well. So I think it's going to be a difficult year for incumbents in Massachusetts, too. But, you know, as Peter pointed out, not to agree with everything Peter has to say, but the three candidates, the fact that there are three candidates makes it much easier for Patrick because he has his base. He's got, you know, the center left of Massachusetts, the Democratic establishment, and he's the incumbent. So he's able to really leverage that into a lot of support.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that Grace Ross seems to be more or less out of the race, we may or may not have a Rand Paul moment coming up later in this election. Who knows? We'll talk a little bit more about that later. So Renee Loth, stay with us. Peter Kanellos, stay with us as well. We've got a lot more to talk about with you and our listeners. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. We'll be back in just a minute. This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I'm joined in the studio today for our News in Review conversation by Peter Canellos. He's editorial page editor for the Boston Globe, and Renee Loth, columnist and former editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. Their work appears in The Angle as well on Boston.com. Listeners, what story do you have going on this week? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join us online at wbur.org/Boston. Let's go straight to the phones and take a call here. Bill is calling from Burlington. Welcome to Radio Boston, Bill.
Thank you, Negma. I'm calling about a story that had got a lot of play, and that's Rand Paul's statement about that private businesses should not necessarily have to serve people that they don't want to serve. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't that interested in what Rand Paul had to say, but it confirmed for me what I've felt all along, that a lot of what the Tea Party movement is a racist reaction to President Obama. It kicked off right after he was elected. A lot of it happens through the South, and I believe this is, we're not in a post-racial society. I think I haven't heard enough people talking about the Tea Party's connection to a reaction against a black president, and I think Rand Paul gave voice to it, and that's why he's in trouble.
Bill, let me ask you a quick question. I mean, you mentioned the Tea Party there, and we obviously saw evidence of the Tea Party's growth here in Massachusetts around the election of Senator Scott Brown. Do you feel that maybe what you saw in Rand Paul's win on Tuesday, that could, could happen here, could return here to Massachusetts in the gubernatorial election that we're looking at?
No, I don't actually. That's a really interesting point, and I'd be interested to hear what your folks there have to say about it. But, Scott Brown, I think, was more a function of something that had nothing to do with race and had a lot to do with the Democratic candidate and his utterly bland appeal. Mm-hmm. But that would be very interesting to see. Somehow I don't think that's going to be a factor in Massachusetts. But maybe I'm wrong about that.
Right, Bill, let's take up your point. Renee, I saw you shaking your head earlier when Bill was talking about Rand Paul's thoughts on business.
Yeah, well, it's important to remember that Rand Paul is a libertarian. I mean, he's named for Ayn Rand, the, libertarian hero of the Fountainhead and the author. His attitudes toward the government's role in individual lives and in the business sector is that there should not be one. And so, it's actually quite consistent for Rand Paul. These are eccentric, I think, not mainstream views, but they're in fact consistent with anybody who's listened carefully to what Rand Paul had to say during his campaign. He's also complaining that, Obama should not be going after BP for the oil spill. You want government interfering with business at any level of gubernatorial, government regulation. So, I think to the extent that's a Tea Party platform or a Tea Party plank, I think the Tea Party's probably trying to make some distance between themselves and Rand Paul now after minutes after they embraced him.
So one wonders what they must be thinking given the financial reform package that just moved through the Senate yesterday, because, as you said, they don't, many members of the Tea Party, Rand Paul, of course, included, don't want any government intervention in business. And yet we have the Senate passing by a margin of 59-39 financial reform bill. With one of those 59 votes coming from Senator Scott Brown, here's President Barack Obama reacting after the Senate threat of a filibuster was broken.
Today, Democrats and a handful of Republicans in the Senate have voted to break the filibuster and allow a final debate and vote on financial reform.
Peter Canellos, so Scott Brown being a key vote in breaking that filibuster and then passing the reform through the Senate, does that surprise you that he's acting this way, or the way that he seems to be maybe truly being what he called himself, a Scott Brown Republican?
No, I'm not surprised, and I actually think it's very smart for Scott Brown to play this role. I think there were two interpretations for his election. One was that he was going to be the 41st vote against health care and that he was going to be a hardline Republican, you know, blocking the Obama agenda. The other interpretation that I think a lot of Massachusetts voters, a lot of Massachusetts independents took to heart was his message that actually he was going to be a force for compromise and a force for reconciliation. And I think he has been on a number of important issues. There will still be a large number of people in Massachusetts who would rather have an activist, you know, liberal, moderate senator, whatever. But there's been an element of truth in packaging in Scott Brown's willingness to, you know, step across the aisle on some of these issues like the unemployment benefits and this financial package. I mean, a package of financial reforms. So I think it's politically smart for him. I think it's consistent with his campaign, and it's very much to his credit.
Well, and also one of those behind the scenes moments in reading actually coverage in the Globe. It was interesting to see that Scott Brown visited Barney Frank in the House Gymnasium. Just the image there of maybe Barney on the Stairmaster. And also took a 40-mile bike ride with Senator Kerry as well. And these were the things that through his conversations with those two key members of the Massachusetts delegation, he felt that Massachusetts banks and businesses would come through this financial regulation okay. So an interesting way of doing business for members of the delegation in Washington.
There's probably a good punchline there, but I can't think of it right off the top of my head. A 40-mile bike ride with John Kerry, wow, that would get you to vote almost anyway. But, you know, Scott Brown was really an empty vessel in a lot of ways. People poured into his candidacy whatever they wanted to, whatever message they wanted to send. And so it's been interesting to see what the real, you know, will the real Scott Brown please stand up and see what kind of senator he's going to be. And so far, I think we've seen kind of a New England Republican. Two of the other votes for this financial regulation reform were from the two Maine senators, the two Maine Republican senators. So I think, you know, he is in the tradition of a moderate New England Republican.
Mm-hmm. Well, the real Scott Brown will have to soon stand up because he's got to run for reelection anyway.
That's
soon.
Right.
Let's turn to our website at wbur.org/Boston. We've got a comment from Paul Schlickman. He says, about the MCAS. It's a wasteful use of old technology. The biggest beneficiary of MCAS is UPS, who transports crates of test booklets to and from every school in the state. We've also got a caller who's got a thought on the MCAS as well. Brian's on the phone from North Andover. Welcome to Radio Boston, Brian.
Hi, Magna. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm a teacher in Massachusetts, and every educator has an opinion. Every stakeholder has an opinion on whether MCAS is good or bad, but like it or not, I think that, you know, it shows what Massachusetts has done, that our students in Massachusetts do well, better than most other states in national testing. And so I'm curious as to what's being proposed as far as working with other states or working with national standards.
Brian, thank you so much for your call. Peter Kanellos, just give us the quick story on what Massachusetts is thinking about doing in replacing the MCAS, potentially.
Well, the MCAS has been successful enough that the Obama administration wants to create national standards, national testing standards, and Massachusetts is one of a group of states that are stepping in to help try to craft what this kind of test might look like. I think it's an understandable fear among some educators in Massachusetts that the whole process of, you know, national compromise is going to somehow lower our standards, that joining the national standards will be lower than ours. But that hasn't happened yet. What they're doing right now is just exploring different ways to create this test. And so to some extent, you know, people's fear of a slippery slope and lower standards have kind of eclipsed reality a little bit. So, you know, my sense is that we should sort of wait and see. And what's going on right now in Washington is actually a compliment to Massachusetts, and it's appropriate for Massachusetts to take a role in this.
Renee.
Well, you know, I would just add one other thing, and I don't want to use the word bribe here exactly, but at that speech, the governor also said that part of the reason that Massachusetts lost out on that first round of federal funding, the Race to the Top funding, which was $250 million at stake, was because we did not agree to join in a national standard. Mm-hmm. Because, as Peter said, our standards are so high and there would be a kind of, you know, lowest common denominator effect and we would reduce our standards. We refused to do that, and apparently that's worth something like 15 points on the competition for Race to the Top funds, and it's part of why we lost out. So our willingness to join in with other states and trying to establish a national standard that we can live with, also will put us back in the game for a second round of Race for the Top funds.
Mm-hmm. Well, we should mention that Secretary of Education, U.S. Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, was actually in town in Massachusetts this week. He mentioned again that, you know, Massachusetts should give it another shot for those Race to the Top funds. And also the state's education secretary currently does say there are no firm plans to scrap the MCAS. But let's get another call quickly in here. Bettina's calling from Beacon Hill. Welcome to Radio Boston, Bettina.
Thank you very much, Magda. I'm glad to hear you've got two good reporters there with you. So I have a question about the Boston Public Library. I've been involved with it for years. People can support the branches because it's a safe posture for politicians and it's a feel-good reaction for our citizens. But it's not addressing the main problem, which is the percent of city expenditures that are given to the library. Years ago, I ran something called the Library Lobby, and I ran the examining committee, and we found that the city, the usual percentage of was 3% of the city expenditures would go to the library. Right now, it's either 0.08 or 0.9%. 0.8 or 0.9%. So here we're talking about the branches. Nobody seems to be talking about the main library, when in effect they should bring that total budget back up. The city expenditures have gone up 65% on average, and I forget how many years, 35% for the Boston Public Library.
Bettina, let's take up your point here because we're coming to a close here, but thank you so much for your call. Peter Canellos.
A couple things. One is that there's state money that goes into the Boston Public Library system, so you probably should combine the state and city to compare it with other cities. So it's a little bit of a false comparison that's being raised right there. But I do want to say that New York, which is a good comparison to ours, has been very successful in raising private money for the library. And it served a larger purpose in kind of really getting New Yorkers, even people who don't, you know, live in the city, invested in the library, participating in library functions and things like that. And I think the same thing would work really well in Boston. So we should look to the private sector to really step in and help the Boston Public Libraries.
Renee Loth.
New York has a different structure, though, than Boston, Massachusetts, or Boston does with its libraries, because the branch libraries are city departments as they are here. But in New York, the main branch library, the beautiful library with the lions down in Midtown, is a private nonprofit corporation. And it's more like the Museum of Fine Arts or the BSO or something. And it's just a different structure. And, you know, I agree that's an interesting proposal, but it's not as easy to get there.
Mm-hmm. Well, last thing before I let you go, it's time for our weekly hubbub, the one story of the week that maybe didn't hit front page or top of our news, but caught your attention. Peter, let's start with you. Your hubbub for the week.
Well, my hubbub for the week is the court in Western Massachusetts that was sentencing juvenile offenders to Shakespeare, to learn Shakespeare instead of performing community restitution or going to juvie hall. I thought that was a great idea, and I think that, you know, for some of those kids, just when you see the pictures of them in their tights and in their costumes and things like that, it was probably tremendously embarrassing. But just the whole act of the whole act of getting into the play, coming to understand the play, working together with the other kids, it probably had an enormous therapeutic effect. So I really liked that story, and I'm glad they did that.
And Renee?
Well, I was tempted to mention the fellow in the middle of the state who is facing child endangerment charges for trying to trade in his baby for two 40-ounce beers at a Chicopee truck stop, but I won't mention that. Instead, I wanted to talk a little bit about interesting byplay at the State House between the House Speaker, Bob DeLeo, and the Senate President. There's only 10 weeks left to the legislative session, and it's coming down to the wire. The House Speaker said yesterday that he doesn't think there's going to be enough time, or possibly there won't be enough time, to take up the Senate President's top priority, which is health care cost control reform legislation. And many people see this as a shot across the bow to try to get her, Therese Murray, the Senate president, working on his number one priority, which is casino gambling and slots at the racetracks. So there's a little bit of horse trading, you should pardon the pun, there between the Senate and the House.
Well, mine involves the MBTA and the fact that this week they launched the Courtesy Accounts campaign, 1,000 ads reminding people to volunteer seats, keep conversations low, make room on the train. You'll see the ads on the orange. the red and the blue lines and city buses. And I'd also add, being a longtime MBTA writer myself, that, you know, on the green line, the B line, maybe having students take off their backpacks to let more people on the train. And guys, sorry about this, but that man sit that occupies more several seats on the train, not a good idea. So that's my hubbub for today. Renee Loth, columnist and former editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. Real pleasure to have you today.
Thank you.
And Peter Cannell is current editor of the editorial page at the Globe. Thanks for coming on Radio Boston.
Thank you, Magna.